Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, the Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Robert Haas and Czeslaw Milosz. In an interview for the Chicago Review, Haas said, "Poetry is a way of living, a human activity like baking bread or playing basketball." Haas served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 1995 to 1997 and is recognized as one of contemporary American poetry's most celebrated voices. He is also a leading translator of the poet Czeslaw Milosz and several Japanese haiku masters. He's been awarded the National Book Critics Circle Award, the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and a MacArthur Fellowship, among others. He currently teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. Czeslaw Milosz's career output is staggering. He has published dozens of books in his lifetime, including collections of poetry, novels, and works of nonfiction, many of which have gone on to become modern classics. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1980. He died in 2004. Now, from the 1993-94 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Robert Haas and Miłosz Czeslaw speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Portland poet and essayist Doug Marks moderates the evening.
I would read a short poem in prose, which is for me important because it presents more or less my basic approach in poetry and in life. And this is a short poem. The action takes place in the Parisian metro. As a student, I came to Paris at that time, a very important place, the capital of the world. And this poem is, in fact, a story of a very short love affair of 1 minute and a half. This is metro, Parisian metro, and Raspail is the name of a station of the metro. I looked at that face, dumbfounded. The lights of metro stations flew by. I didn't notice them. What can be done if our sight lacks absolute power to devour objects ecstatically in an instant, leaving nothing more than the void of an ideal form, a sign like a hieroglyph simplified from the drawing of an animal or bird? A slightly snub nose, a high brow with slickly brushed back hair, the line of the chin. But why isn't the power of sight absolute? And in a whiteness tinged with pink, two sculpted holes containing a dark, lustrous lava. To absorb that face, but to have it simultaneously against the background of all springing boughs, walls, waves, in its weeping, its laughter, moving it back 15 years or ahead 30. To have, it is not even a desire. Like a butterfly, a fish, the stem of a plant, only more mysterious. And so it befell me that after so many attempts at naming the world, I am able only to repeat, harping on one string, the highest, the unique vowel beyond which no power can attain. I am. She is. Shout, blow the trumpets, make 1,000 strong marches, leap, rend your clothing, repeating only is. She got out at Raspail. I was left behind with the immensity of existing things. A sponge, suffering because it cannot saturate itself. A river, suffering because reflections of clouds and trees are not clouds and trees.
Bob? I don't know where to go in it, response to that. I could either read about perception or about 1.5 minute love affairs. I don't know what. Here's a poem about love that takes a longer view of the matter. This poem was inspired when I read somewhere that 2 million acts of copulation were going on the earth at any given moment. And it's called Privilege of Being. Many are making love up above the angels in the unshaken ether and crystal of human longing are braiding one another's hair, which is strawberry blonde and the texture of cold rivers. They glance down from time to time at the awkward ecstasy. It must look to them like featherless birds splashing in the spring puddle of a bed. And then one woman, she is about to come, peels back the man's shut eyelids and says, "Look at me." And he does. Or is it the man tugging the curtain rope in that dark theater? Anyway, they do. They look at each other, two beings with evolved eyes, rapacious, startled, connected at the belly in an unbelievably sweet, lubricious glue, stare at each other, and the angels are desolate. They hate it. They shudder pathetically like lithographs of Victorian beggars with perfect features and alabaster skin hawking rags in the lewd alleys of the novel. All of creation is offended by this distress. It is like the keening sound the moon makes sometimes rising. The lovers especially cannot bear it. It fills them with unspeakable sadness so that they close their eyes again and hold each other, each feeling the mortal singularity of the body they have enchanted out of death for an hour or so. And one day, running at sunset, the woman says to the man, "I woke up feeling so sad this morning because I realized that you could not, as much as I love you, dear heart, cure my loneliness." Wherewith she touched his cheek to reassure him that she did not mean to hurt him with this truth. And the man is not hurt exactly. He understands that life has limits, that people die young, fail at love, fail of their ambitions. He runs beside her. He thinks of the sadness they have gasped and crooned their way out of, coming, clutching each other with the old invented forms of grace and clumsy gratitude, ready to be alone again, or dissatisfied, or merely companionable, like the couples on the summer beach, reading magazine articles about intimacy between the sexes, to themselves and to each other, and to the immense, illiterate, consoling angels. Thanks.
Thanks, Bob. I think one of the marks of great poetry is that as you get into a lifetime's work, you realize how inexhaustible it is. And this is certainly true of Czeslaw's work, and Bob is building his own shelf at the moment. Thinking about this evening's program, I thought that rather than deal with political issues, historical issues, kinds of topical affairs, that one of the opening questions might go to the heart of their work. So I would like to ask Czeslaw to talk to us a little bit about his sense of the daemonic as a source of inspiration in his poetry. He has, in interviews, talked about the fact that he is often seized by trances, as he puts it, and this is different than automatic writing, I presume, and I'd like him to extenuate on this a little bit.
Yes. Once I had a conversation with the painter, Dian, and I asked him how he became painter. He said, because I didn't know how to do anything else. And I guess that the question of daimonion is a certain detachment which in various situations which are unbearable in life protects us by talking, by speaking, whispering incantations, and you are so busy with those incantations that you are not paying attention to sufferings in you and around. And this is, of course, a question which tormented Thomas Mann, a certain inhumanity of the artist who is protected in a way by a certain shell. Incantation is not necessarily that a poem is already dictated. The first line is dictated.
Hmm. The first line?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you have to find a logical, necessary supplement to that first line. And of course, I have written once a poem to my daimonion, which I can read.
Explain
case one part.
Explain what you mean by daimonion.
By daimonion, I mean
we didn't all have an education in Latin and Greek.
D A I.
A being which dictates to us. It's very difficult to know who he is, but in any case, we hear his whisper. So the poem is My Daimonion. It is certain I couldn't have lived differently. I would have perished if not for you. Your incantation would resound in my ear, fill me, and I could only repeat it instead of thinking about my bad character, the decline of the world, or about a lost laundry ticket. And it seems that while others loved, strove, hated, despaired, I have only been busy with listening intently to your unclear notes, to change them into words. I had to accept my fate, called today karma, for it was as it was, though I didn't choose it, and get up every day to honor the work, even if there is no guilt of mine in it and no merit.
Thank you. That about says it all. But now I'm going to put Bob on the hot spot. I first encountered Bob's work in this anthology, The Young American Poets, 25 years ago, when Bob was just a boy in a bit. And in this anthology, I won't show them the picture, Bob. Each of the poets was asked to write a short mini-essay, one might say, about their work, to which Bob responded this way. I like poems for the peace involved in reading and writing them. I began writing seriously when I found that I could write about myself and the world I knew, San Francisco and the country around it, in a fairly direct and simple way. For a long time, I felt a compulsion to direct myself to large issues. This was mainly due to the cant I acquired around universities about alienation. About the time that the Vietnam War broke out, it became clear to me that alienation was a state approaching to sanity, a way of being human in a monstrously inhuman world, and that feeling human was a useful form of political subversion. So the exploration of where I am in this place in relation to that person, place and person both caught somewhere between the old movements of the unconscious and the brutal accidental collage of one's historical and geographical presence in the world, and the writing about it as carefully as possible are a way of being for a while one thing, no persona, no middleman or structured ambiguities, no talk about the artist. This is distinctly unlike the kind of motive force, one might say, behind Czeslaw's work, and I'd like to ask Bob two questions, whether he still writes that way, or whether you too are inspired by the daimonic.
I want to ask how would you like to have your high school love letters read on stage to a bunch of people?
Fortunately, I knew Bob in those days, so...
That I see that quoted from time to time.
I'm sure.
Can't I acquired around the university. Can't is a word you only learn in the university. You know?
Have you shed yourself of such figures of speech?
I've been spending my life trying to unlearn that language. Yeah.
It is a more pragmatic approach, though, isn't it?
Yeah. The one articulated there, well, no, it's actually programmatic in its way. Mm-hmm. Peace and, I mean, it was 1968. People, black children had just been killed in a bombing in a Birmingham church. The Vietnam War was starting up. Kennedy had been assassinated. People were being shipped to Asia. Mm-hmm. It felt like an extremely violent time. And so to speak about peace and pleasure seemed a form of resistance to that craziness to me at the time. And it's one that has a, you know, it turns out was not very original at all. It has a lot to do with a long West Coast aesthetic of juxtaposing, you know, the life in the natural world to the violence of social life. So it was pretty predictable.
How predictable is it today?
But yeah, I mean, the part of it that interests me now is what I, when I said pleasure, what I really meant was work, mm-hmm. which really is the deepest pleasure to be. It's as Czeslaw was describing in the poem that, you know, finally the great gift is to be working at what you love to do in a way that so that everything else disappears and that you disappear into the activity. And that was, I mean, I think that the truthful thing in there was that I was discovering my work and what a deep pleasure the work was.
Would you find that process more important than the product itself, the poem?
Sure.
It still holds true for you.
I must say that I ask myself to what extent Daimonion, whom I mentioned, is a moral or immoral person or being, because I have been in many situations during the last war and under the Nazi occupation, and obviously my daimonion was furious very often, and he seized me against my will to write poems which were expression of my indignation, anger. So I am not sure that the daimonion is a voice of detachment. Hmm. Both, I guess.
Would you say that your good daimonion is one that is non-historical and more the philosophical poet that you like to...
I am on the side of that philosophical daimonion.
I know you are.
But I have been seized many times by...
But it's one. You've said in other poems that you're inhabited by many voices. Are these all different spirits speaking?
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, you know.
Would you like to share with us a poem
The art of our century is full of contradictory voices and contradictory personalities. For that reason, a Russian scholar, Bakhtin, analyzing the novels of Dostoevsky, coined a word polyphonic novel. And so I guess that our poetry in the 20th century is strongly polyphonic. We are seized by voices coming from various sides and from even various Weltanschauungs. Hmm.
Would you like to read another poem, Czeslaw?
Yeah, okay.
Great. We'll hear some of those voices.
I would read a short poem which sort of completes the one I have read. And it is entitled Blacksmith's Shop.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I was in Lithuania this year after 32 years of absence, and I was in the place where once that blacksmith shop stood, and I, as a child, was fascinated by what was going on. And here is the poem. I like the bellows operated by rope, a hand or foot pedal, I don't remember which, but that blowing and blazing of the fire, and the piece of iron in the fire, held there by tongs, red, softened for the anvil, beaten with a hammer, bent into a horseshoe, thrown in a bucket of water, sizzle, steam. And horses, hitched to be shod, tossing their manes, and in the grass by the river, plowshares, sledge runners, harrows, waiting for repair. At the entrance, my bare feet on the dirt floor, here, gusts of heat, at my back, white clouds. I stare and stare. It seems I was called for this, to glorify things just because they are.
Bob is a poet of things as well, but he has a much different approach to them than Czeslaw does. There's a sense in which Czeslaw's entire life seems to be a concerted effort to penetrate to the essence of things, the objective world. And one of the things that really struck me about the last lines of that particular poem is his urge to glorify. And one of the things that I do find in common about both of your work is this willingness to assert something, whatever it might be, in what might be called the face of a kind of chronic despair that is so rightly justified by historical events of this century, and your determination not to despair in that way. And Bob, in fact, your whole second book, Praise, deals essentially with that. Do you find that this is a meager tradition? Do you find that there are literature generally has had a despondent note since Eliot and the Wasteland, or is this something that is chronic and not likely to resolve itself in any easy way?
Well, I defined myself as an ecstatic pessimist.
I've heard that phrase before.
Czeslaw probably won't tell this story, but speaking of Eliot in despair, there's a great moment in his book, The Captive Mind, in which, is it in Warsaw? He's walking across the city, and somebody starts strafing the street with a machine gun, and he falls down on the ground. He has a copy of Eliot's The Wasteland in his back pocket, which he's been reading and translating into Polish, and the cobblestones on the street, struck by the bullets, stand up like quills on the back of a porcupine as the machine gun runs, and he's lying there with his cheek to the ground, thinking to himself, T.S. Eliot might not be the answer.
You're listening to Robert Haas and Miłosz Czeslaw speaking in Portland in 1993. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and there's more from Haas and Miłosz coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, it's Robert Haas and Czeslaw Miłosz. Back to their conversation now in Portland from 1993. Portland poet and essayist Doug Marks moderates the evening.
Well, I think the issue of despair in our time is a big one. And I'm always interested to read poets who assert, no, this is, regardless of the circumstances, this is not a position I'm going to take.
Yeah.
And as I say, both of you have, and it's not a matter of sentimentality. Each of you understands that there's a mixture of horror and wonder around us, and it's trying to deal with that.
It seems to me that reality is a great cure against despair. In general, we can see in poetry of our time a very strong movements towards subjectivity. But there is another kind of poetry which honors reality, honors things existing. And I feel that there is in America a tradition of Walt Whitman, who wanted to devour all the things of the world. And I feel that I am indebted to poetry of Whitman, which for the first time I read in Polish translations, but I didn't know English at that time. But what I like in poetry of Bob is precisely that presence of reality, palpable reality. And I am an admirer of Dutch painting, Dutch still lives, which besides German philosopher Schopenhauer considered as the highest achievement in art. And this is precisely represents detachment, certain distance, at the same time, an amorous relationship towards things.
Bob, would you like to read a poem?
Yeah.
Do you have one that fits?
I just happen to have dozens here.
Poems for all occasions?
Yeah. Again, I don't... there are different ways to take this. Here's a poem that I guess is about this business of looking. And it's also a prose poem during a period when I thought prose was just a way of getting down the prose of the world. It's called Museum. On the morning of the Kathy Kollwitz exhibit, a young man and woman come into the museum restaurant. She is carrying a baby. He carries the air freight edition of the Sunday New York Times. She sits in a high-backed wicker chair, cradling the infant in her arms. He fills a tray with fresh fruit, rolls, and coffee in white cups and brings it to the table. His hair is tousled. Her eyes are puffy. They look like they were thrown down into sleep and then yanked out of it like divers coming up for air. He holds the baby. She drinks coffee, scans the front page, butters a roll, and eats it in their little corner in the sun. After a while, she holds the baby. He reads the book review and eats some fruit. Then he holds the baby while she finds the section of the paper she wants and eats fruit and smokes. They've hardly exchanged a look. Meanwhile, I have fallen in love with this equitable arrangement and with the baby who cooperates by sleeping. All around them are faces Kathy Kollwitz carved in wood of people with no talent or capacity for suffering, who are suffering the numbest kinds of pain, hunger, helpless terror. But this young couple is reading the Sunday paper in the sun. The baby is sleeping. The green has begun to emerge from the rind of the cantaloupe, and everything seems possible.
I'd like to engage both of you in a common question. Cheslov has written about the fact that some poets work with ideas or images. He's a poet of language. Bob, image has been a central feature of your work from the beginning. And I'd like Cheslov to maybe explain a little bit what he means by being a poet of language, his language being his essential mode of operation, if you will. And then, go ahead.
Oh, but he also said, if to be a poet is to love language, then I am not a poet.
That's the other side of Cheslov.
Yeah. Well, polyphonic.
Yeah. But exactly, I think, you know, image, idea, metaphor, people understand fairly readily the idea of language itself.
We could talk
back and forth about his ideas about language.
We could.
While he stood in silence, not letting him speak all night. It would be a great metaphor for the situation. Go
ahead. No, I guess that every poet is deeply involved in the language of a given period of the language. For instance, Bob is a California poet, and there is a whole development, the line of Californian poets, and I observe with great interest how the language of California poets changed, beginning with Sterling and Jeffers, going through Rexroth, now to Bob Haas. As to myself, I am embedded in the history of the Polish language, and of course I write always against certain tradition, for certain another tradition. So this is a constant struggle for imposing my own vision of the language.
How do you feel about the image? Do you feel it still is hanging in there as a viable mode of communication, if you will?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it... I mean, I'm not sure...
Not that images are absent from Czeslaw's poetry.
I'm not sure how to talk about images because they show up because that's the way I see, I think. For me, poems begin with rhythms of language. Mm-hmm. Always start there.
We're... Oh, this talk about, you know, seeing what is and Czeslaw's insistence on the real. We were talking one time and someone said to us, but there is no real. And Czeslaw said, all the more reason to... So, and then I came across this description of realism in an 18th century book, which was the treatment of low persons and subjects. So this is realism of that kind, and it's a recent poem, still unpublished, and it's called Shame, an aria. This might take the discussion a different direction. You think you've grown up in various ways, and then the elevator door opens and you're standing inside reaming out your nose, something about the dry air in the mountains, and find yourself facing two spruce elderly couples dressed like improbable mountain wildflowers in their primary color, definitely on vacation, sports outfits. A wormy curl of one of the body's shameful and congealed lubricants gleaming on your fingertip under the fluorescent lights. And there really isn't too much to say as you descend the remaining two flights with them in silence, all five of you staring straight ahead in this commodious aluminum group coffin toward the ground floor. You are, of course, trying to think of something witty to say. Your hand is, of course, in your pocket, discreetly transferring the offending article into its accumulation of lint. One man clears his throat, and you admit to yourself that there are kinds of people, if not people in particular, you hate, that these are they, and that your mind is nevertheless working like a demented cicada drying its wings after rain to find some way to save yourself in your craven small child's large ego's idea of their eyes. You even crank it up a notch, getting more high-minded and lugubrious in the seconds it takes for the almost silent gears and oiled hydraulic or pneumatic plungers and cables of the machine to set you down. Nose picking, you imagine explaining to the upturned reverential faces, is, in a way, the ground floor of being. The body's fluids and solids, its various despised disjecta, toenail pairings left absently on the bedside table that your lover the next night notices there, shit streaks in underwear, or little faint odorous pea blossoms of the palest polleny color, the stiffened small droplets in the sheets of the body's shuddering late night loneliness and self-love,
russets of menstrual blood, toe jam, earwax, phlegm, the little dead militias of white corpuscles we call pus. What are they but the twins of the juices of mortal glory? Sap, wine, breast milk, sperm, and blood. The most intimate hygienes, those deepest tribal rules that teach a child, trying to struggle up out of the fear of loss of love from anger, hatred, fear, they get taught to us, don't they, as boundaries, terrible thresholds. What can be said or thought or done inside the house but not out? What can be said or thought or done only by oneself, which must therefore best not be done at all? So that the core of the self, we learn early, is where shame lives, and where we also learn doubleness and a certain practical cunning, and what a theater is, and the ability to lie. The elevator has opened. The silver-haired columbines of the mountain are murmuring over breakfast menus in a room full of bright plastics somewhere, and you, grown up in various ways, are at the typewriter thinking of all the slimes and jellies of decay, thinking that the zombie passages, ghoul corridors, radiant death's head entries to that realm of terror claim us in the sick middle of the night sessions of self-hatred and remorse, in the day's most ordinary, hidden, watchful self. The man not farting in the line at the bank, no trace of discomfort on his mild, neighbor-loving face. The woman calculating the distance to the next person she can borrow a tampon from while she smiles attentively into this new man's explanation of his theory about deforestation. Claims us also by seepage in our lies, small malices, razor nicks on the skin of others, of our meannesses, deprivations, rage, and what to do but face that way and praise the kingdom of the dead. Praise the power. We have all kinds of language to elide the fact that none of us can worm our way out of, that no man can evade, which all must kneel to in the end. Praise it by calling it time. Say it is master of the seasons, mistress of the moment of the hunting hawk's sudden sheen of grape brown gleaming in the morning sun. The characteristic slow gesture, two fingers across the cheekbone deliberately, of the lover dreamily oiling her skin in this moment, no other, before she turns to you, the face she wants you to see, and the rest that she hopes, when she can't keep it hidden, you can somehow love, and which, if you could love yourself, you would.
Oh, hell. Czesław, would you like to read another poem?
I wonder, this would be the last one or
no?
No.
Do you want to save one for the last one?
I wonder.
Two more? This one, and then we'll have one to close on in 10 minutes or so?
No, because this is a poem which I plan to read. This is a poem about my mother and sort of recent poem.
Read that poem.
Maybe I would read it later.
Okay, you want to save that?
So,
I do have a question of both of you again, and yeah. That is to do with your individual perspectives on or relations to nature. And I know that Czesław has an almost lovingly combative sort of attitude about necessity, the ironclad laws that we live under by virtue of nature's will, one might say. And Bob has a distinctly, there is some overlap, but Bob's is different. His is a little more Eastern looking. And I'd like to hear the two of you talk about these respective positions.
I would read a very short poem about the world.
The world.
The world.
but it's a really, really a joke.
A very short poem about the world.
Joke.
Modest poem.
The world. It appears that it was all a misunderstanding. What was only a trial run was taken seriously. The rivers will return to their beginnings. The wind will cease in its turning about. Trees, instead of budding, will tend to their roots. Old men will chase a ball, a glance in the mirror, they are children again. The dead will wake up, not comprehending, till everything that happened will unhappen. What a relief. Breathe freely, you who suffered much.
Bob, how would you respond to that?
I was thinking about his attitude toward nature. Someone called me once to try to get me to get him to read in an anti-nuke reading, and he shrugged as if it was something he had to do but was a little unwilling to do, and he said, "Why don't they ever demonstrate against aging?" That's where the resistance to nature comes in. Yes, that's where. I thought I would read a poem that has something of that movement, of one part responding to another part, that's also a meditation in the mountains in the Rexroth mode. It's called Dragonflies Mating, and I gave each section small titles. Summer, he constructs an idyll of family. The people who lived here before us also loved these high mountain meadows on summer mornings. They made their way up here in easy stages when heat began to dry the valleys out, following the berry harvest, probably, in the pine buds, climbing and making camp and gathering, then breaking camp and climbing and making camp and gathering. A few miles a day, they sent out the children to dig up the bulbs of the Mariposa lilies that they liked to roast at night by the fire where they sat talking about how this year was different from last year, told stories, knew where they were on Earth from the names Owl Moon, Bear Moon, Gooseberry Moon. 2. He remembers that the world is made out of forgetting. Jaime de Angulo, 1934, was talking to a Channel Island Indian in a Santa Barbara bar. "You tell me how your people said the world was made." "Well," the guy said, "Coyote was on a mountain and he had to pee." "Wait a minute," Jaime said. "I was talking to a Pomo the other day and he said Red Fox made the world." "They say Red Fox," the guy shrugged. "We say Coyote." "So he had to pee and he didn't want to drown anybody, so he turned toward the place where the ocean would be." "Wait a minute," Jaime said. "If there were no people yet, how could he drown anybody?" The Chanaleño got a funny look on his face. "You know," he said, "when I was a kid, I wondered about that. And I asked my father. We were living up toward Santa Ynez. He was sitting on a bench in the yard shaving down fence posts with an axe. And I said, 'How come Coyote was worried about people when he had to pee and there were no people?' The guy laughed. And my old man, he looked up at me with his funny smile and said, 'You know, when I was a kid, I wondered about that.'" Three, he remembers the real family. Thinking about that story just now, early morning heat, first day in the mountains, I remembered stories about sick Indians, and in the same thought, standing on the free throw line, St. Raphael's Parish, where the northernmost of the missions had been, was founded as a hospital, was named for the angel in the scriptures who healed the blind man with the fish he laid across his eyes. I wouldn't mind being that age again, hearing those stories, eyes turned up toward the young nun in her white, fresh-smelling, immaculately laundered robes. The Franciscan priests who brought their faith in God across the Atlantic, brought with the Baroque statues and metalwork crosses and elaborately embroidered cloaks, influenza and syphilis and the coughing disease, which is why we settled an almost empty California. There were drawings in the Mission Museum of the long, dark wards full of small brown people, wasted, coughing into blankets, the saintly Franciscan fathers moving patiently among them. It would, Sister Marietta said, have broken your heart to see it. They meant so well, she said, and such a terrible thing came here with their love. And I remembered how I hated it after school because I loved basketball practice more than anything on earth, that I knew if my mother was going to show up well into one of those weeks of drinking she disappeared into and humiliate me in front of my classmates with her bright, confident eyes and slurred speech and the appalling, impromptu sets of mismatched clothes she was given to when she had the idea in that state of making a good impression. Sometimes, from the gym floor with its sweet, heady smell of varnish, I'd see her in the entryway looking for me, and I'd bounce the ball two or three times, study the orange rim as if it were, which it was, the true level of the world, the one sure thing the power in my hands could summon. I'd bounce the ball once more, feel the grain of the leather in my fingertips, and shoot. It was a perfect thing. It was almost like killing her. 4. First song of the bewilderment. What if the dark sang, this is the owl's night, that is the owl moon, who gets the words right, what is the wrong song, what if you killed it, this is the hard way, who would be watching, what if she felt it, what can you give her, wouldn't you rather sit by the river, sit on the dead bank, deader than winter, where all the roots gape, they are your mother. 5. Dragonflies mating. This morning, in the early sun, steam rising from the pond the color of smoky topaz, a pair of delicate copper-red, needle-fine insects are mating in the unopened crown of a Shasta daisy just outside my door. The green flowerheads look like wombs or the upright, supplicant bulbs of a vegetal pre-erection. The insect lovers seem to be transferring the cosmos into each other by attaching at the tail, holding utterly still and quivering intently. I think, on what evidence, that they are different from us, that they mate and are done with mating. They don't carry all this half-mated longing up out of childhood and then go looking for it everywhere. And so, I think, they can't wound each other the way we do. They don't go through life dizzy or groggy with their hunger, kill with it, smear it on everything, though it is perhaps also true that nothing happens to them quite like what happens to us when the blue-backed swallow dips swiftly toward the green pond and the pond's green and blue reflected swallow marries it a moment in the reflected sky and the heart goes out to the end of the rope it has been throwing into abyss after abyss and a singing shimmers from every color the morning has risen into. My insect instructors have stilled. They are probably stuck together in some bliss and minute pulse of after longing, evolution worked out to suck the last juice of the world into the receiver body. They probably can't separate until it is done. 2nd song of the bewilderment. If you're afraid now, fear is a teacher. Sometimes you think that nothing could reach her. Nothing can reach you. She is on fire. I didn't set it. You didn't set it, but you are a liar. What is the owl song? Who picked the berries? Where did the moon go? What did the noon sing? She is on fire. Open the door then. I can't release her. You can't release her. What if you killed it? I fear my desire. That is the fire. We sing our desire.
That was Robert Haas and Czeslaw Milosz in conversation at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1993. Both poets of critical acclaim, Haas and Milosz were colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, and Haas remains the leading translator of Milosz's work. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.